Yes, we were about to move to Texas, but before we do that, I had wanted to ask you, during that period that you were at Monsanto, according to your list of your bibliography, I counted, well, maybe 30 to 40 papers that you had written while you were at Monsanto.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to ask you about a couple of them specifically, but first of all, what was the attitude of Monsanto towards your publishing this kind of information?
Well, this group that I had, which was a sort of an engineering research activity, both at Dayton and then later at St. Louis, did enough generic type work, not process or product related, that we could usually get an approval. It might take a while, maybe we had to sit on for a while. And I encouraged that in the group. In other words, I had really top flight, mostly PhD chemis, and I said, I think you ought to always worry about your visibility, your employability on the open market. We'll try to hang on to you, but think about your resume. There ought to be some publications on there, particularly if you want to go into teaching. And so our group did a fair amount of publishing, the only difficulty being that some people are not all that inclined to write, even if they could get clearance. So I think Monsanto had a pretty good attitude. I know there was one paper that was cleared for a person in my group. It was a solo paper by him, which had to do with some real mistakes that Monsanto had made in a startup. And my feeling was, well, this would be a service to industry so the others wouldn't make these same mistakes. It did make us look pretty dumb. And we had to argue over that one a little bit, but they finally agreed to do it. It was published in one of the AICHE journals. So our work was enough generic that we could do it. I also encouraged these people to teach short courses. That was permitted in our employment contract. And since I was chairman of the AICHE Continuing Education Committee at one time and a charter member, and we had an in-house program that was a very good one, it was pretty easy for us to provide a course that was wanted by the AICHE. So in my group, I had six or eight of the people who were teaching AICHE courses and still teaching. So I think Monsanto was a very generous, maybe liberal, policy on sharing its technical developments with others, as Shell Development was back in the 40s and 50s, and DuPont also through the years, including Perry's Handbook.
Yes, I wanted to talk to you about Perry's Handbook.
That was a tremendous contribution to the profession.
I think that, well, that came later, but you about, well,
I was at Monsanto when yes. I started on the Perry's thing.
That's right. Well, why don't we, I looked at that paper that you had on the history of the handbook, which is, of course, your interest in history shows up in a number of other papers
yeah.
as well. How did you get involved in doing that?
I worked side by side at Shell with Bob Perry, the only child of John Perry. And I was always fascinated by his stories of his father in the handbook and the money that he brought into the family. When Bob took over the handbook and recruited me to do a section, I talked with him about this story, and we really ought to tell it. And so we wound up by splitting it into a two-part paper, one part by him, one part by me, but my part being approved by him. I didn't want to put anything in there about his father that he wouldn't want to see. But he was very happy with it, the way it was. And so I took John Perry up from his early days and how he put this thing together. And it was a very successful enterprise. Now, as you may know, Bob Perry was tragically killed in an automobile accident in England. And McGraw-Hill and his widow had a lot of negotiation about the handbook. But there will be a seventh edition. They're beginning to talk about it. And the editor-in-chief now is one of Bob's old associates at the University of Oklahoma, named Don Green, who's now at Kansas University on the faculty. So there is criticism of the handbook these days that it is no longer really a handbook. It's too involved in theory and fundamentals, and that what the profession really might want is just a handbook. Give references to how you got these pieces of information, but make it simple and useful. I don't know. That's a comment that's come in many times. It may be ripe for competition on that basis. Don't know.
Was John Perry was originally in Cleveland?
Yes.
And was he associated at Case? Was he at Case at all?
No, he was with a DuPont subsidiary company.
Griselli?
Griselli.
Okay.
And he got started on the handbook while he was in Cleveland.
Because Hodgman, who edited the first handbook, chemistry handbook, was at Case.
I see.
At the same time.
There and could have been a lot of influence
I
there.
Just wondered whether there,
was, there
any,
was
any connection there at all.
Now, right behind you, see the little brown book to the left of that, is an earlier handbook of chemical engineering, a McGraw-Hill book.
This one?
No, the Liddell. It's a two-volume set right
oh,
there.
Yes. Oh, yes. Okay, I'm sorry.
So there had been something of a handbook before Perry's. The red book over to the right is the first edition, and then the green one is the second edition. So I met John Perry at an AICG meeting, but I knew him mostly through his son. He was a chain smoker, and he died of cancer, throat cancer, at a relatively young age.
A lot of your publications while you were at Monsanto dealt with distillation technology in one form or another, and you had a number of annual reviews of current
yeah.
techniques, kinds of things. I'm just looking at a title here that I pulled aside, one title, Conversion of the Transport Phenomena Purist.
I gave that at an AICG meeting as part of a session at a time when some chemical engineering departments, including Washington University, had dismissed traditional chemical engineering and going into more of an engineering science program. This was happening back in the 60s. And the idea was to emphasize a fairly theoretical and pure type of training for the engineer in that industry, convert this person into a useful, productive engineer. So that had to do with that. Here's what he knows when he comes in. Now, what do we have to do with him in industry to make him useful? Got a lot of interesting comment.
Imagine.
Yeah. It grew out of an invited paper at an AICG meeting.
Well, you had another one, Educating Tomorrow's Process Designers Realistically.
That was a collaboration with Buford Smith, and a fairly comprehensive article on how industry and the university can work together to teach undergraduates the elements of design. Now, in our curricula in chemical engineering, we have a very firm requirement that all engineers take a capstone course in design, one that will bring together their thermo, their kinetics, their separations, their transport operations, and show how it can all be used, blended with economics. So that's a requirement. It worries many faculty and people because they don't feel qualified to teach it. So what we initiated, Buford and I did, was a program to get industry people into the classroom to do this course. And we had four special meetings at a rural location in the Missouri Hills, sponsored by the National Science Foundation and the Ford Foundation, where we brought in maybe at a time maybe 50 educators, and in some cases an equal number of people from industry that we could identify as being potential collaborators. And those worked out pretty well, and some of those collaborations are still intact. We had Standard of Indiana working with Notre Dame. We had Standard of California working with Berkeley. We had UOP working with Northwestern, Phillips with Arkansas. And at these sessions, we would go through the methodology of teaching a design course collaboratively. They were very popular. We had a fixed number we could accommodate with our money. And we did that four times. These were so-called Bromwoods conferences. And at those conferences, Buford and I, and usually a couple of others from Monsanto, would take turns in dealing with various topics. So that article summarizes some of the things that we accomplished. And I think that it would be a good article for some people to review again, because we're getting away from it. Most of our faculty these days have not had practical design experience, and so they really aren't qualified and don't want to teach the course. At this very time, they're searching for my replacement, someone with a separations background who's willing to administer the separations program and teach the design course. The last one is a tough one.
It's interesting that I've heard and I've noticed that chemical engineers today, someone has said to me, nobody's building a plant anymore. And concerns in the environment. And so is that partially responsible for this?
Well, I think it's the economy, but there is a lot of capital spending on waste handling and treatment facilities. That's still going strong. And that may involve the design of a large and expensive plant. Also, there are some things like, in fact, they're due to environmental causes, such as plants to produce additives for gasoline. I don't know whether you've come across the MTBE, that's methyl tertiary butyl ether, which is a sort of a tetraethyl lead replacement for gasoline to improve the NOx rating. And the lead then does not get into the environment or foul the catalytic converters. MTBE construction is going pretty strong. There are some ethylene plants, but by and large, there is a lot less classical plant design and construction. More chemical engineers are being involved in microelectronics projects, not so much biotechnology projects. So we just have to see what the future brings. I remember working on ethylene plants thinking that surely now that we're up to X billions of pounds per year, that we certainly don't need any more ethylene capacity, but it keeps going up. So I don't really fear for the industry, although right now the so-called commodity chemicals are not setting things on fire, but they are stable. And in the case of Monsanto, which 10 years ago decided it was going to go very heavily into biotech, and they've spent a lot of money on biotech, they do not yet have their first real product from their research. It hasn't been cleared yet. So the industrial chemicals keep bringing in the cash. Fibers and fiber intermediates, inorganic, heavy inorganic chemicals, and certainly petrochemicals. So they're still there.
Dictation in the engineer.
Oh, there's one. Well, that one grew out of a discussion I had with one of the editors of Chemical Engineering magazine. And it really had to do with a little crusade that I had had in my department. But this was before word processors. That our engineers were taking an outlandish amount of time to prepare simple reports and letters. Usual practice was to write something out in hand, ask the secretary to do it in draft, correct it, then the secretary would type it in final. My theory was, why don't you dictate it? You can still get a draft if you want it, and you can correct to that. But better still, dictate in final. And that's what this paper had to do with, techniques for leapfrogging to the final copy, the discipline involved. And it's been very helpful to me. I dictate in final, although it's changed a little bit now, because I can dictate something in final and I will get the beautifully typed copy, but it's been done on a word processor. So I know that if I want to change a was to a were, there's no sweat. So that makes you a little bit more relaxed on dictation. Also at that time, there were a lot of people around, at least in Monsanto, who could take dictation directly. I liked that. That's the way I'd prefer to do it. But those people had to know shorthand. Don't find very many people that know shorthand anymore.
It's true.
So that article, it talked about pocket dictating machines. How you might dictate a technical report, how you deal with equations.
That is an obvious question.
Yeah. And the answer was, you need to have your equations prepared in advance pretty well, and then you have the secretary leave space for those equations and then put them in after the second pass. You just can't dictate equations. So that was kind of a fun thing. Just, it was part of a special section on technical writing.
Get much response to it?
Oh, yes, yes. And I've still used that copies of that old article for some of the women around the building, even here. But I've always gotten good marks for my dictation. And I think it's because I can, better than some, visualize what it's going to look like on the paper as I talk about it.
You did an international textbook on distillation.
Yes. That was a little book to teach non-chemical engineers how to handle some of the elementary calculations of distillation. It was used quite a lot in Monsanto by the plants and their operator training programs. But it's not a very impressive book, but it's got the principles of distillation in it.
So the
graphical materials.
Impetus came from the Monsanto need.
Yes, okay. For training.
Mm-hmm. By 1972, you were that's the time that the fifth edition of Perry, I guess, was coming out. But I was intrigued by, talking 20 years ago, you were emphasizing environmental concerns, and you had a paper called Trace Quantity Engineering. And in there you talked about the already growing environmental concerns.
Yes. Yes, that was, I guess you might say, a sort of an attempt to develop a new discipline called Trace Quantity Engineering. It was all built around the need for control and analysis of small amounts of materials that could be harmful to the environment. So that was the thrust of that one. Sampling and analysis were very much involved. A choice between alternates, adsorption versus scrubbing versus incineration. So that's really what it was. It was dealing with cleaning up liquid and gaseous discharge streams.
What kind of response was there to something like that? I mean, to me, it seems like you were probably in the forefront of calling attention to those concerns.
I would say that the response was not all that great. If you measure it by requests for reprints, which is hard to do these days because of copy machines, I've encountered a lot of people who recognize the article or recognize the author of the article. But in general, it did not touch off any usage of the term, TQE. We used it around Monsanto because of that article. Sort of like at the time there was a commercial, did you DQ today? That means did you go to the Dairy Queen? Mm-hmm. Did you TQE today? But it was trying to get people interested in not just cleaning up, but finding out by analysis and evaluation whether a cleanup was even needed based on regulations.
Well, in your short bio at the end of that paper, it indicates not only your Monsanto connection, but that you were a member of the Executive Committee of Fractionating Research Incorporated.
Yes.
That was the first time I had seen that term.
Well, we call that FRI. It's still in existence. It was formed in the mid-1950s as a stock company a closed research company, and the share owners would be companies interested in the results of distillation research. FRI had its officers and staff and research facilities in California. It has since relocated to Oklahoma. It has perhaps 70 or 80 member companies right now. And a fairly good budget. But its technical program is steered by a technical committee. And so my first assignment was on that committee. We had, at the time, 6 members of the committee from our various companies. It's grown to 9 now. Actually, 9 plus a chairman. But when we formed this corporate engineering department in St. Louis, and I brought in Bill Bowles, B-O-L-L-E-S, from Texas City to be my distillation specialist, I got him on the technical committee. So they asked me to serve on the executive committee. And in that capacity, I got involved in the negotiations to change FRI from a stock company to a member company, and to negotiate with the IRS for it to be considered a non-profit company and not taxable. So I served then on the executive committee and as vice president until I left Monsanto. I now attend the meetings as a consultant. So I keep up with what FRI is doing because it could result in duplication of the work that I'm doing here at the university.
Another paper during that Monsanto period was something called Process Design, Past, Present, and Future. That was 20 years ago, but one of the things that intrigued me, and you have touched on this earlier, was how you noted the decline in the coursework required for a degree in chemical engineering.
Yes, and it's really unfortunate. We're right now faced with another problem in that here at the university, but at that time, we were recognizing that you really needed 5 years, and the most appropriate thing would be a 5-year professional degree that would get in those hours that you really needed. That has not sold. People don't want to spend more than 4 years worth of tuition. We have simply had to do away with a lot of very useful courses. And the thing that was troubling me at the time was I felt that the academia was saying, well, that's okay. Let industry do that. Let industry do the training. We don't need a design course. They can go to industry and they can take a good in-house design course. So there's a lot of controversy about this, and at the moment at the university we're faced with having to free up 6 hours to take courses in of a multicultural type. There's been that kind of pressure put on us to do that. Engineering's opposed to it. We have a problem in engineering of attracting students simply because our workload is heavier than the others. That's always been the way.